The Team Never Quit podcast is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. If you're ready to tackle homeownership, go check out Navy Federal's mortgage options with zero down payment. You can learn more at NavyFederal.org.
I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I guess technically I am by definition. I guess I'm technically an author. Yes, I guess I'm technically this. But what I was doing was my friends are all dying by suicide and they're doing it at a pace that I do not find acceptable. How do I help? I don't know. So why don't I start helping myself and then give myself the tools to then go and help others?
Never quit radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you everybody for listening, watching, viewing, and subscribing. And please give it a thumbs up or a subscribe wherever you get this channel. So before we dive in today's special guest, let's kick it off with our Patreon question of the day, which is, would you rather go back in time to meet your ancestors or go to the future and meet your descendants?
Oh, that is such a fantastic question.
Yeah.
Ancestors.
That is a good question.
Ancestors.
That's so hard for me.
I would like to meet my descendants. Also, just to see what the future is like.
Yeah.
If there is one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like that would piss me off and you couldn't do it. But if you go backwards, then it's like, you know, it's back in time.
Yeah.
If it's in the future, then I obviously had something to do with
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, I'm here for that.
Yeah,
I knew my great-great-grandparents. So I feel like, yeah. So up until I was 10 is when they started dying. And then had my great grandparents until my 30s. And then now my grandparents are starting to die, which is so sad. But I feel like I know a good part of my ancestry. So I think I'd want to go in the future and have some sort of influence on future generations.
It's a good question.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I've never been asked that before. I like it.
Because when you have, and another thing, when you have a bunch of grandparents or great grandparents online, you can see your. You can, because it's only four generations.
That's right.
They say people don't change, the times change, but times change the people. Mm-hmm. And people change in the times.
Absolutely.
So if you can actually get a good idea of certain times in history and how people act just by looking at what today, you can get a kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have tech, obviously.
Yeah, that's a different thing altogether. Yeah. No, I would go way back, though.
Way back.
I want to go to like the first, and I want to know exactly who
what the hell happened.
Exactly. I want
to
know who.
What'd y'all do to get us right here?
Exactly.
That's right.
I love that.
Yeah, I would definitely like, if I could just pick anybody's brain in my ancestry, on both my mom and my dad's side, my ancestors went from France to Canada for just the travel route down the Mississippi into Louisiana. And they formed in Louisiana in the late 1700s. And they've never left the area.
Do they sound like the Acadian French, that real thick, like...
Yes.
Creole, they mix it all together.
Yeah. Why do people talk like that? Get the rocks out of your mouth.
They can't, that's what they...
Crawfish and mashed potatoes.
But they don't, they've never left. My parents were the first of...
The towns are named after them.
Yeah.
How about that? And then they marry each other from the other. That's how you know.
How you know.
I'm not even. I thought that was a myth. I went down in there after I married into this clan, and it's real.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
I'm fucking deep in there,
like,
too,
deep
man.
Rooted. Deep
in
there.
Oh, very rooted. And so I would want to know why they left France. If I was to, like, go
it's
back
France.
And pick...
Yeah, we could still be in France.
There's your answer. Yeah, you're overthinking this question.
I just want to meet them.
I was in Texas, so there you go right there.
There you go. Your paths had to align somehow.
Yeah.
That's true, though. I remember looking her history there. It's there.
Yeah, my history is very rooted.
This is it.
That's it.
It's is it Tom Segura who makes a joke about Louisiana? He said they should build a wall around those people. And I don't disagree. That is a different place. That is a different vibe.
There's a swamp.
I know. That is their wall.
If you've never been through there, just think about it when you, because you got to go over a bridge.
Right.
Before that was there, it's like, how would you even get through that? Well, I mean, you had to be determined to get the hell out of there.
Exactly.
That was serious. To get to California through
all this. We're keeping you out.
Oh, well, there you go. That's a great way of looking at it. It's always the other side, right?
Because like, we really like
it. We didn't want to go in there. It's like, good. Yeah. We didn't want you in there anyway.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that.
That's a good question.
I'm very proud of where I'm from. I love it there.
For sure. So today we have Kelsey Sharon, who's a combat veteran and artillery gunner in the Canadian military, who served in Afghanistan in 2009 with the Canadian, American, and British Armed Forces. She is currently the CEO of Brass and Unity, host of the Brass and Unity podcast, and author of Brass and Unity. Welcome to the show, Kelsey.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. Honestly, it's a pleasure.
We know you're from Canada, but where? Give us a little background.
How did this start?
How did you become this? Yeah, to this.
I grew up in a really small town in Ontario on the East Coast. As people will correct, it's not the East Coast. It kind of is, Mid-East.
We live in that kind of area here.
Yes.
I know what you're talking about.
The outer and the inner loop.
That's right. That's right. There in the heart.
So I grew up in a really small town. My dad was a long-haul truck driver. Mom stayed at home. And my brother and I were in a ton of different sports. Because of where I grew up on 17 acres of woods and out in the middle of nowhere. It was very much... really incredible childhood. I didn't have to have these cities and all these influences. I could just be outside. I could be doing a lot of different sports. And so ultimately, I got into Taekwondo, and I got in at about 4. And that's when...
This is because your brothers?
No, my brother...
Anybody in the family do martial arts?
No, my mom did when she was older, but there... So when she was younger, way back, but she didn't do it for... She did karate for a little while, but it wasn't...
Was it a movie?
No, it was... My mom was at a mall and saw one of those demonstrations.
Oh, that's got you. And so the Taekwondo guys can put on a demo.
Yes, but it's not applicable in real life.
Okay, we don't have to get into that whole rabbit hole.
I'll go down it.
I know you will. I will too, all day long. Mm-hmm. It's my favorite thing to talk about in martial arts. But let me tell you,
karate growing up.
Y'all can put on a freaking demo. Man.
Yeah, oh yeah. And like crazy level shit. So we went, my mom called me from the mall and was like, hey, you know, when we start something, we finish it. So if you sign up for it, you got to finish what we sign you up for, whether you like it or not. Like, this is what it is. So I went and I fell in love. And then cut to 4 to 13 and then the 19 and 20, 18, 19 and 20, that was my life. So I got to a point where I became a really high level competitive fighter and then a national level fighter by the time I was 12, 13. And then I had my first kind of world blow where you realize the world is not all innocent and that not everything is great. And that's kind of where the innocence died in me a little bit and the little anger streak that came. And my coach decided he was going to sexually assault my teammate for a couple years. And she was underage, obviously. And it was a whole thing. He ended up going to jail. And it because that was my coach from the age of 4, that affected my trust in the world, my trust in men, my trust in people and all of that. So my brother got into motocross at that point, and that's when my dad would go with my brother, my mom would go with me, and we would do all of our sports. When I got into high school and along those lines, that's when rugby came in, and I got really, really gnarly into rugby, and that's how I tore my eyelid off and got a few concussions and did a bunch of stuff, and it was a really good way to work on aggression without having the tool that I had as a child, which was the outlet was Taekwondo. And then we moved to a even smaller town for my last couple years of high school. And those were my first 2 years not in a Catholic school. So I got to learn what small town, hockey team, farm kids, groupthink looks like.
They're different.
It's a vibe, man.
That's a vibe, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was a whole experience. So then building that anger a little bit and that frustration and a bad breakup, and I wanted out. So I went to college as soon as I graduated. So I was 17, and I went to Ottawa. And Ottawa, Ontario is where the capital of Canada is, although it is the smallest, so it makes no sense. Waterways, I get it, but I digress.
Location, right?
Yeah, location, right? Back when the queen was... So I went there and I joined for a program I had no interest in. And I was never a book individual anyway, where studies were something I was hyper-focused. It was always sport my entire life.
Mm-hmm. So parents pushed you to college?
No.
Or that's just the route.
She wanted out of the town. And it was the route out. So I took they accepted me for like travel and tourism. What even is that? No one knows.
Is that a Canada thing? Because the only other Canadian we've had, Trevor, did the exact same thing.
Yeah. So it must be. I don't know.
He said he had a kick-ass time.
Exact
too. Yeah.
Same thing.
Yes, exact same
Sounds
thing.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
He's the most well-rounded dude I know.
Yeah. And
that kind of job will do that too.
It will. Exactly. You learn because you're learning about everything. And so I end up going down to a Remembrance Day ceremony. So you guys have Veterans Day on November 11th where you say Happy Veterans Day. And then we have Remembrance Day where we wear poppies and everyone is solemn. Or most people who are educated enough are solemn and the rest are ignorant and say, Happy Remembrance Day, which is fun. So I went down to the ceremony in Ottawa because my whole family, like we always had respect for the military. I didn't grow up with military. It didn't come from the bloodline. Until I found out when I was writing this, my grandfather, who I didn't meet, unfortunately, my dad's dad, served in World War II.
So you do have it in your bloodline.
Yeah. Just don't know about it. So I joined.
Back up for a second. Have you traced your lineage yet?
Yes.
How many more military you find in there?
Only a couple. Yeah, because so my dad's side, it's heavy Scottish, Irish, super white dudes that were farmers. And then my mom's is Hungarian. Mm. And so my grandfather left Hungary when the Soviets invaded after World War II, when he was running out of the country and he came to Ontario and that's where they settled.
Yeah, that's my backfield too.
Yeah.
Farmers and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it builds an interesting human. It definitely
So with the martial arts,
yeah.
When we're kids and we're growing up, there's the discipline in there, mm-hmm. focuses, it gives us something straight to do. And then there is that time, for whatever reason, because they teach it as a self-defense.
Right.
And then we get whatever happens to us when we switch that.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're waiting for it.
You're just waiting for it.
Waiting for it.
I've
never run into anybody else who puts that much training to what we did that doesn't happen to.
It's wired in. It's like doing any rifle drills.
I get that. I think what happens is that's a part of us going through phase.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you actually have to step away from part of it to appreciate that first part.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I have kids.
Yeah.
And right now I'm hitting them with the Miyagi, the philosophy.
Good.
And then I'll make them do some stuff that there's movements in it just so they can protect.
Yes.
That whole ground game.
Yes.
But I did step away from it. It's always there, and if I had to use it, boom, quick.
Can always go back to it.
You can always go back to it. But now I noticed as I get older and the kids, because we're pushing it back down, that comes into play. Absolutely. Matter what style, and it's styles, right?
Yes.
I was like, hey, man, which style do you look good doing? Which one works with that body?
That's right.
And then you don't appreciate that when you're younger. It's just like fraternities in college. It's like, my style is the best. What do you even...
Exactly.
That whole thing.
Yeah, no, I learned the hard way. I learned a long time ago that Taekwondo was not super applicable in real life if I was being grabbed from behind. It just, you know, that's a different level. That's where jiu-jitsu comes in. And that's why we put my son in jiu-jitsu, because I want him to be able to de-escalate situations. I don't want a striking sport so he doesn't have as many concussions. I don't, you know, I think about long-term repercussions, what he's doing to his brain. So Taekwondo, I was in the WTF, which meant you could knock somebody out.
We know what that is.
Exactly. Yeah, so I don't want him to be concussed 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times in his life.
You know, that's where all the martial arts came online. Different body types having it in a different scenario. They were like, hey, how do you get out of that?
Yeah,
and 100%. Then people started running with it, and then we got separated by land or whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you finally, MMA brought that together. I mean, if you've got a kid who can do both, and the perfect martial art is just to get out of the way of everything.
Exactly. Just avoid. Just avoid. Just avoid the situation.
And if you can somehow get that in you, I got it now. Yeah. I do it all the time now. Avoid it.
Yes, absolutely.
And they say that, but man, you can't understand. You're like, no, I'm learning all this cool stuff. I want to use it.
Yeah. Like, no, that's not real life, though. You don't need to.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, 100%. No, I feel you on
that. Great?
Completely. So that's why we put him in. Yeah, that's why he's
ours
doing
too.
A little bit. Yeah.
We started him in the scouts, and in our family, if you get that Eagle Scout and a black belt, you call it a Black Eagle.
Oh, Jesus. Yes.
That's a qual.
I like that.
If you get that,
that's
those two things right there, you're good.
You're good.
I trained this sucker from the minute I got him and everything, but if you, I know for a fact, and those have been road tested by all types of people and all types of situations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of things that we have implemented on Earth.
Yeah.
That if you put them in that kid and try to grow a human, you'll get a good one.
Yeah. It's
great fertilizer.
It's not, I don't say that growing a human isn't hard. It's not too difficult if you put some damn effort into it.
Exactly. How about that? There's that routine, man. Them suckers want to raise themselves.
Routine is the key
it's
to
such
success.
A key, man, it is.
Oh, I know our kid, like clockwork, he won't even look at his watch and he'll just go, feel tired. I think it's bedtime. On the dot, just without even asking.
Our little ones do that,
they do
too.
That too.
Yeah,
it's great. They've always done it.
Zars are around the same age. This new generation, they're calling them alphas. Like,
good.
Which I think so too. Because we were so extreme, and you got that gap in between. And then
been a rough gap.
Yeah, it was a rough one.
Yeah, it's a rough
but
gap
that,
there.
That COVID thing, and then all these young ones, man, they'll be something.
I saw a meme yesterday that said, if your mom is between 36 and 44, don't mess with her. She was raised by Biggie and Tupac.
Yeah, yeah. Violence will ensue, and they have no issue using
wars,
it.
Wars, martial arts, freaking hip-hop.
Exactly. And serious hip-hop. Back
whiskey,
then
I mean, you can't name what they threw at us.
Exactly.
And it works. And we made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I had to send it to Hunter, because I'm 44. I'm like,
story.
I did. But I sent it to you directly.
Hey, some of the stuff that comes out of our people's mouths and what they put together is so hilarious. I mean, it just, I laugh so hard I hurt myself.
That's good. Oh, and you should. So good. That's how you know you're living a good, fulfilled life.
Man.
If you're laughing to the point where you hurt.
Where you hurt.
Mm-hmm. That's my goal. That's why I'm trying to have more comedians on my show, because they make me happy. I leave happy. Talking to them, but it's a different level of happy.
Whatever it is they got in them. Whatever that is, it tickles. When they say tickle your funny bone. Yeah. It does that.
And when they know the type of person you are, they'll throw in like dark humor because they know they can get away with it.
They can get away with it.
And it just gets you deep.
And that's how they communicate. And we were talking about this earlier. It's like the minute our comedians go bad, we're in trouble.
It's over.
Yeah. The minute they go dark and stay that way, like where they're openly trying to hurt you with it, then that's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, we need them guys and gals to keep... I don't care how they come at you, but do it with a damn smile.
I know. I'm fine with it, but you make me laugh and you'll get me every time. I'll be
every
okay.
time.
Oh, okay, forget
every
it.
Every time.
Forget it. It's disarming.
Yep. I hope, you're right. These last few years, they've been getting hit hard too.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I appreciate them so much more, because you understand how dark. Well, and anybody goes through anything in mental health, you can understand how comedy is levity.
Boom.
And how it heals. I just think it heals. I think it's a form of art. Because I believe in art therapy so much, it is a form of art that not only heals the individual that is doing it and gives them the outlet to speak out of the things that were so heavy on themselves and relieve that and kind of put that burden on others, if you will, but they do it in such a way that it heals the ears that it's healing, because that it's hearing it, because there is always, you will always relate to someone. You'll find a comedian that you like and you'll like them for a reason, and then they'll say something and you'll go, oh my God, I remember that. That was my childhood. Yeah. You just... Comedy heals.
Pulls from the inside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you'll always want to watch a fight or a disaster, but you want to hear somebody laugh.
Every single time.
And
I
mean, if we're in here laughing the whole... we don't have to take any drugs. We don't do anything. And if we laugh for a few hours, you don't think about anything else.
Yeah.
And you can even think about bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you're laughing about it, when you walk out of here, everything, you got a bliss on you like you can't believe.
But that's how people cope.
Shows, too, like how y'all are in the military.
They did something to it. That happens. Yeah, something happened to
laughing in the darkest times. Yeah. I mean...
Well, you have to. Otherwise, you will cry.
Yeah.
You have to pick a lane and just commit.
Yeah.
I think what happens to us is, so when you get put in the darkness, everyone's afraid and timid and we don't know what to do, right?
Right.
But then we get comfortable in there.
Yes.
So then the real you comes out.
It's like Batman.
You want to talk about humor. When you can laugh, when the hell's all around you.
Yeah.
But then when you see somebody who's comfortable in it, man, and they can start being themselves and that joke flies out because they're having to deal with the chaos. It's just magic.
That was my game changer. Comedy was a game changer for me. I had a lot of good, funny people around me. My husband is, he's not like, oh my God, my husband's funny. He's got like bits, and he like gives them to me when we're in the shower, and it is he won't stand up and do them, because some of them are rough, but for me they're everything. And he cracks me up better than anybody else I know.
I love it.
Anybody else besides Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, man.
That was a gift to
thank
the
you
earth.
God for Dave Chappelle.
I know, that was a gift to the earth.
There's a couple of them walking around down here where you're just like, thank you.
He's just thank you for existing in the world, and I guess you're awesome. Like, it's great.
So going back to your story, did you do anything with the travel and tourism at all?
No, God, no. So
military.
Yeah, I went right.
That's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. I went in, I went to the ceremony, and I met a lady on a bus coming back. And she had an Air Force uniform on. She had come from the ceremony, a very elderly looking lady. I was like, oh, this woman's. And I have a tendency, if I see someone, it could be anywhere, but something in me and right in my little feely spot will go talk to them. And I go, okay. And I just go over and I talk to people, and I got talking to her, and something clicked in me. And it was like that moment in a movie where you look back and you go, this is the moment where the main character takes the turn of the fork in the road, which one is she going to pick? And I something clicked, and I went to the recruiter's office, and I said, I want to join the Army and I want to be on the front lines. And they were like, well, honey, you know, we're in an active war and we're deploying every 6 months. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm really fit. Like I'm a very fit individual, and I want to do something where I actually feel like I'm affecting something, or this isn't worth it. So why don't you just put me in infantry? And so here's the thing about Canada. We can do that. Your women just started in 15. We've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
We've been running and gunning. If you can get it, if you can do it, they'll let you do it. Then they looked at the height of me and said, how about no? And I went, okay, what about? And they said, how about artillery or armored? And I said, well, tin can, explosives. I don't like being claustrophobic. Big guns, big boom, the hand of God. Yeah, let's give that a run.
It's tin can explosive, but you're on the outside.
But I want to be like, yeah, I don't want to be inside. Yeah. And so, because I would end up being a driver for sure, because I'm perfect size. So I went artillery, and they were dagged red, meaning they needed more individuals because of the rotational deployments. And so I sent my paperwork in that week. I quit college the next day.
What year is this?
This is 2007. And then by January, I was sworn in before 2008. By January 4th, I was in basic training. I was done, and I went like basic training, SQ, DP1, posted to my regiment that I was deploying with in September of 2008, and then deployed in April of 2009. Now, not all regiments are the same in Canada. I got posted to a French-speaking only regiment.
Mm.
I speak English.
Yeah.
And so I got posted there, had to learn French, and then I was the only female.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the 777 gunner, so I had to learn how to work with all these dudes, which is fine with me, I have no issue. I was always a tomboy. I always make jokes that if I were a 16-year-old this day, people would have tried to transition me because my hair was this short. No, I'm not even being like facetious. Like, my hair was this short, I wore a wife beater a lot, and my tearaway pants, and I was at Taekwondo every day. So it's like, where are we going here? And so I was always tomboy, and I was always good with that. And so I got lucky because the sergeant at the time was not like a fan of me, because he figured, well, that's one less person on the gun. She's not going to be able to load it, because the 155 millimeter howitzer has a just under 100-pound round that goes up to 40 kilometers. And so to run those guns, everybody has to be effective at their job. And so I just had to prove myself a lot, which was fine. I have no issue with that. I think if you come in and you look the part, it's a different thing. This dude walks in, they're not going to question whether he's going to chuck around. It's just going to be fine. And so I knew going in there was going to be these standards I had to meet, and that's okay. I'm not saying it to complain about it. I'm saying I'm good with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hit the standards, did the minimums. And we didn't have two standards at the time where women had a different standard than the men. It was the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I had fitness background, it helped me a lot succeed in the military. So we ended up deploying in April, and we got word that we were going to be the Canadian regiment that was going was Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, and two guns on each run. Those guys were, Charlie and Bravo were going to Canadian FOBs, but I was going to an American FOB. So I went to FOB Ramrod. And so we were there. There was some 101st guys there.
Yeah.
And we were ripping out a reservist artillery unit there. But my guys didn't speak, a lot of them did not speak English. And then the Texas guys didn't like that. And so it was a really interesting dynamic to be a part of. But I would just screw around with them on the comms and stuff and just like speak in French. And they'd be like, oh, ma'am, you're going to have to come back again on that.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great.
Let me tell you something. Sometimes when a voice would come over that radio, you're like, where is this coming from again?
Exactly. Yeah. It was a great time.
I used to tell people I was an English translator.
Oh, perfect.
I could only translate English. That's all I get.
Different versions of English.
Different versions of it.
Well, you got her family down at
That's what I'm talking about. Right in the redneck. Exactly. Right here, man.
I love it. No, I love that. So yeah, we are.
Because when you roll in on our FOBs, we would have the Texas flag flying.
And you guys, not only that, your accent was so thick that sometimes it was hard even for me to understand.
I remember, that's funny, because we always ask
He has words that I don't understand still last night.
And I was talking for minutes before you said something. I didn't even realize that.
Oh, our 12-year-old and I are looking at each other like, what is Dad saying? And I'm like, I have no idea, but he doesn't sound mad, so let him just go with it.
Just let him roll. He's just telling the story.
Yeah, no.
And then he looks at us as if we're supposed to answer, and I was like, Axe actually said, Dad, We didn't understand.
You know, Dad's
one...
all right. So sorry, I started getting irritated. Why are you answering me?
Why are you answering me? He goes,
I can't understand a damn word you're saying.
He goes, we
man.
Don't understand one word that came
I'm
out.
I'm like, oh, all right. Well, I was talking in cursive. It's all right, man. If you don't, if you don't
when
talk,
you get
I,
comfortable, the twang comes out in a real
a
way.
A lot.
In
if
a
I
heavy
get excited
way.
Or kind of, yeah.
We say he talks in cursive because his flow sometimes just doesn't,
I used to
the
drink
words
too,
don't
and it would,
end.
It did pretty.
Oh man, I feel like that would be.
Yeah, it helps.
It was bad.
It helps
that would
with
be
the.
Thick. Yeah. That would be real
it brings
thick.
It,
like
brings
two
the
C's.
Thickness back.
Yeah.
I don't whiskey bring out thickness back.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate
that's
that.
That's funny, man.
But yeah, those guys were great. That's why I got to work with the Americans. That was, so we got to support. We got to do a lot of shooting support for those guys, which was fun. It's always great to see how things are run. And then I got to. And then on that FOB, there were a couple situations in the book. You can dive into it. We don't need to, I don't want to waste all your day. So there's a couple situations, though, that I was a part of inside the FOB. And then because I was seen as the weak link, so Al-Qaeda like to target the weak one. And so it ended up working out in my favor, not so much in his, which was fine with me. And then I got a call. My sergeant got a call, and he came to me in the tent. He said, hey, you know, Burns, you're going somewhere, huh? And I said, okay, where are we going? Because we're bored. Like, let's go outside the FOB. Let's go play a little. We're FOBits here for a hot minute. I mean, we're racking rounds downrange. We know what we're doing here. But
how long were those rotations there?
Say again?
How long was your rotation there?
6 months.
That's right. Sorry.
Yeah. Canadians do about 6 to 9 months, depending on. Especially combat arms, they roll
this
six.
This is 08, so they keep you all...
09.
09?
Yeah. Yeah.
Still 6 months? Y'all didn't get pushed longer?
Mm-mm.
Because remember, I think it was in 10 is when they started doing the year.
Yeah,
the
after
year.
9, they started cracking because 9 was vicious for the British and the Canadians. We lost.
And American, 9 and 10.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
When I was with those guys, that's the only time. I wasn't with the
that's
Americans.
That's a gnarly time to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting.
01, 05, and 09 and 10.
Yeah. It's funny because when I say that to people, the people who know, they go, oh. But the people doing it was like, yeah. Yeah, they go, wow, okay, what were you doing in 09? I was like, oh, we're doing this and this. And like, oh, okay.
And there's a difference because a lot of times, like, there's war.
Yeah.
Like, if you're over there, you're in combat. They're always shooting at us, and that gets overlooked.
Yeah.
Because then the guys that are and the girls are, everyone's in war, but then some of us would have to go in deeper into combat.
Yeah, kinda, there's levels to this
there's
game.
Levels,
there's
people
levels.
People don't understand that. I'm like, yeah, man, that sucker was there at this, especially at that time.
Mm-hmm. And I'm real respectful about it. I try to be like, people have to stay at CAF for a reason. You need every single human in the military to
that's
be
right.
successful.
You hear certain
range.
FOB names too. Mm-hmm. Like if you hear they'll be like, oh,
Bastion or like some of those British ones or in Helmand and stuff. And I hear about them, I'm like, oh, I don't want to go anywhere near that.
They made a documentary about Restrepo.
Yes, that's right. Because look at Restrepo. You heard those words and you go,
they
I don't
hated
go there.
That, but that was the sexiest deal, they hanging it out like that.
You know what?
I mean,
I'm glad
that way
did.
Out there.
Yeah, and that was ballsy.
Them boys, yeah, the clank.
Yeah.
All the ones they sent out there, man. There's a couple of FOBs in our world that when you hear those names, you're like, ah, dude.
You just know the feeling, and it's a nasty feeling. So when we were with the Americans, it was nice. We only had to patrol one of our towers. The rest of them, the Americans covered. So that was nice. But we had the one, we would do the 4-hour shifts there and then on and off the guns. And then we would transition 1 week with the Americans to do GD so we could have access to your showers and then your food. And then we would kind of stick on our little side of the guns. But the call came that I was going to go with the Brits. And so back then, like I said, they had, you know, there was women truck drivers and there was women on doing frontline type positions, but there was not women on combat arms roles. And so at the time, the British needed a what you guys now call CST, but not this type of CST that was like, let's go hang out and like feed you and talk about your village. It was like, I'm going to take you into a room and we're going to hang out. And so I was in charge of the women and the kids. And so that would allow us to do full searches rather than the guys going in and say like missing rooms or like they would hide things on women. And that was a beautiful way to hide comms that they weren't supposed to have or a bunch of money that you would give it away. Like, hey, you've been paid by somebody. Let's figure out why.
You want to talk about when we got dangerous is when they integrated us.
Yeah.
Women and men.
It's hard
and,
though.
And when they, well, then y'all could accept we were in the houses because every time we go in, there'd be women and men.
Right.
Kids.
I thought you were talking about women in the military.
No, I'm talking about with us.
Yeah, because they get sketchy real quick.
That's right. And they blame stuff on us. Uh-huh. And then there's an actual confidence that comes when we would have the women around because they would go do their deal with the women and kids and we could deal with ours. And it was like that's where we learned this. They didn't do this in the other wars.
No. Because they will hide things and they will use the women and children. And if you don't have somebody that can properly base off of religion and be respectful, you know, Geneva Convention, can't touch them, you can't look at them, you can't go near them.
You talk about that for months.
Exactly. So I would go in with them, but what I was told was nothing. So I got picked up from the FOB and I got dropped off with the Brits and they said, we're leaving at 0100, have your stuff prepped. This is what I need you to have. We're on foot for the week. So carry what you need to carry and we'll do reloads when we can. We're not expecting to need you and we're not expecting for it to be a fight. We're going to do this. We're going out, but I was never told objective. I was never told what I was looking for. I was told once we get off the Chinook, follow the bomb dog. So you follow the bomb dog, that's a black lab in the pitch dark. Follow that guy and him and you stick with them because you're going to be with them and you're going to be with the medics. So we want to keep...
And I know everyone's like, well, why didn't you put a light or a chem light on it? I mean, so it can glow in the dark?
We did that
once we don't we do got... that because we don't want to glow in
exactly.
the dark.
Exactly. And if you see Benji kicking around with that, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know. So anyway, I went with them and they said, you know, the first day of the operation, they said, we got there in the middle of the night. First day they go... We're gonna start kicking doors after morning prayer. And so that's when you'll know, like, high alert, like, we're gonna start rolling. And what was gonna happen is I was gonna be passed around. I love how that sounds. I was being passed around to different units.
Say it again.
Yeah. Tossed around to a bunch of men. Yeah. And so I did. And so as soon as they actually kicked the first door in, they called me up right away. And then I got used and like a bicycle at that point because now it was everywhere they were going, the women and kids were staying and it got nasty. So every time we moved to a different compound, there was firefights. It was not what was expected. And the only reason I believe I was able to be successful, not only successful, but I was able to be a useful additive rather than just somebody that was searching women and kids and actually doing the door kicking and actually assaulting the rooms was because my sergeant, Mark LeBlanc, at the time had remustered from infantry to artillery. And while we were doing workup, when the other guys were getting days off, we were house clearing. We were doing our weapons training. We were running and gunning. We were making sure that there was no chance in my mind that I didn't know how to clear a room properly. I did not know how to not shoot and move. I made sure that I wasn't a liability. I was an asset. And that was all I wanted to do. Simple.
Plenty of practice back then because they knew we were coming. Because
we'd wait for
the prayers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about that? We're nice guys, right?
Nice guys, because we got to be respectful. They don't wait for shit, but we're going to wait for that.
After breakfast, time for the Americans to come rolling through that door.
And 3, 2, yeah, boom, so, boom, boom. Yeah. That's what they would do.
All day.
It's like clockwork. So then the situation, we end up having, that week end up being so bad so that by the end of it, I end up getting pulled and brought to the doctors and they diagnosed me and they started putting me on heavy drugs right away. It was a whole thing. And basically, we don't have to get into it. I've told the stories before. They're in the book. They're graphic and they're aggressive and they're what war is. There is loss. There are IEDs. There are firefights. There are close calls. There are things that happen in war that happen in war. And so we go through that. But I try to say this because this is not a war book. This is not a war story. That is a blip of a moment of my life. And everyone wants to focus on that. And that's okay. And I'm cool with it because I did get to do something not a lot of women did. And I'm proud of that.
Oh, yeah. Sure. It's great. That's because it's a great story. And it's exciting.
Thank you.
And you're welcome.
I appreciate that. When you stack
something, most people will go through their life and have one of your moments to hang on.
Yeah.
Just one.
Yeah.
I'm not. And then you have a lot in one arena. And then you go out and get into another arena and have more. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so... that all happened, and ultimately, I got sent back. I finished the operation with the British. I did what I needed to do. Like, I was their asset, and it worked, out. Came back with a lot, and we had a lot of ramp ceremonies, and a lot of things went on, and then they medicated me, and they sent me back to my FOB. Here's what they didn't do. They didn't tell my superiors I was on drugs. And when I say drugs, I mean 11, and I was 100 pounds. So I was highly over-medicated, running a machine gun and a 777. So stuff started to happen, and I almost pulled the trigger on somebody outside the FOB who was a little girl that was normally there. When I was seeing her waving, it wasn't waving though. And so I caught myself in that moment and I ran to the comm stand and I said, something's wrong. Because I went from talking a lot to not saying a word. Mm-hmm. And for them, they're like, okay, we got an issue here.
Yeah.
And then I just stopped sleeping.
Where do they have you on?
Oh, I would have to look at the list, but I actually just recently saw it when I was doing my TBI paperwork. But it's antipsychotics, antidepressants, sleep medication, uppers, downers, you name it. It was just, we need to get her to sleep. We need to make sure that she's not having outbursts. We need to make sure that she's not falling apart. It was those types of drugs. So it was a flat line of a numbing that would happen.
I'll tell you what, man, they made our generation into. And I was like, I'm not a resident expert, but I'm good enough to know if someone doesn't know what in the hell they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to drugs.
Oh, we are dialed.
Our generation can not only tell you what it'll do to some type of person, yeah. how it does, if they're doing and where they're at in the routine.
And the long-term damage it will cause.
That's what I was talking about. PTSD is pharmaceutical training, standby for dosage.
It's exactly what it is.
Because all of us went through it.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. That shit is brilliant.
It came to me in a moment when I was like that.
I'm here for that one.
It's all yours.
I'm using that now. It's all you. That's great. But that's true. We were vending machines for the government.
I can tell you what that stuff, if we had to be trial and error, trial education, test and evaluation, which basically we sign up for, I get that.
Yeah, we were getting
it. So now you know what some of that stuff does, especially because we've been doing it for years.
Yeah. And that's why I'm not on any of it anymore.
Yeah, nothing. I won't even take an aspirin.
No, that's a rarity if you have to take a pain pill. And you got to be like...
And I'm thinking about it too. I'm like, man, that sucker. Yeah, I'm the same way.
Because we had to become the educated group of that. So after all that happened, I went on my HLTA, which is our break that we get. And it was...
What do they call it?
HLTA.
Gotcha.
And it stands for something. But we went and I met my mom somewhere in the Dominican because you can fly your next kin. And we spent 3 weeks together and that was the... worst weeks of my life and outside of the actual operation because my mom saw the side of me that she didn't recognize, right? She saw what war looks like with a child and she didn't know how to deal with it. And I was 19. So it was I came back to Afghanistan and it just got nasty in the calf. I would start popping off on superiors because if I didn't have any rounds in my magazine and you're walking around a calf, you'll get ripped for it. Well, I didn't have any left because I used everything I was given and I was never given any more. My braid was too high. They would rape me for that. So I started just warrant officers, just telling them where to go. And so they were like, okay, you can see there's a reaction and nobody knew how to deal with mental health at the time. Nobody understood that the reactions I were giving were disproportionate for a reason and not intentional, but because my frontal lobe had shut down and I didn't have an executive function control. I couldn't stop myself because I was not functioning. So they sent me back 3 weeks early to my old unit. No one was there. They gave me a piece of paper, said, drive to Ottawa, you're out. Peace, see you later. Never saw my guys again. Never was contacted again. Military didn't call for 6 months. And that's when things got really dark and that got really bad. And that's when the suicidal ideations. And then I was medically released in 2011 with a 3B med release, told I would never work again. And then at that point, who's now my husband, I was with my boyfriend at that time and I moved out there. And that's when I got new doctors and a new team. And I'm with the same psych that I got then. And he served in Bosnia and Rwanda. And he was one of the first doctors in Canada to do research on PTSD veterans. And he is a veteran. So he served, he understands me. He's like, he looks like he's from Texas. He beats my ass when I need it. And he has corrected me and course corrected me. And to that point where it got to up to 2020 again, where I was getting worse. We didn't know why. I had gotten off of a lot of the stuff. I had a successful company. We had done all the markers. We were on Ellen. We had Kevin Hart. We had Julian Huff. We had Michael Bublé. I should have been fine. I had a child, a healthy marriage. I had everything I'd needed, but I was getting worse.
You know what that is, Ryan? Mm. That's a wartime attitude in a civilian world trying to raise, do all that. Look what you said.
I know.
What you've accomplished. That most people never even think about doing that. But since you did it with a war mentality, a warfighter mentality, you don't appreciate, you can't celebrate it.
I just did it as art therapy to get my life together.
As a freaking thing to do, as a mission. That's exactly what that is. And I came up with this one the other day too. So when we come in, when we check on board and you start a war, it's like walking into the gym. And you don't get out of the gym till we get out.
Right.
And then the soreness comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time we go through something horrible, normally there's a break. And most people don't experience something horrible once or twice. Mm-hmm. So we always have them. Mm-hmm. But then there's no downside for us. I always just stack one more thing on top of it.
Right.
So it's like plate after plate after plate. So then when we get out and we're by ourselves.
Uh-huh.
That was another horrible thing. That was another isolation therapy. So you got to look at everything that we went through as they were doing something to us.
Yeah.
Not like it was happening
to us.
Or not like it was happening to us. Like, hey, this is just like all the specialized training we have.
Mm-hmm.
I switched it in my head like that. I was like, okay, you want to run that stuff to me and see what it turns me into? Fine.
I'll show you what it turned me into.
Yeah. And then you just keep going. Then the next one, there's always somebody ahead of you and behind you.
Absolutely.
All right, check.
Yeah.
And that's why they put us out one on one. So when we reconnect, I'm like, hey, sister, I got you, man. Yeah. I know exactly where you're coming from and where you're coming up.
It's hard because I talk to a lot of people. I do a lot of podcasts. But if I'm not in a military podcast and I'm having these conversations, they're like, great entrepreneurship, great business mindset, great blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, you don't get it. I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I guess technically I am by definition. I guess I'm technically an author. Yes, I guess I'm technically this. But what I was doing was my friends are all committing dying by suicide, and they're doing it at a pace that I do not find acceptable. How do I help? I don't know. So why don't I start helping myself and then give myself the tools to then go and help others?
Yeah.
And that is what it is. It's never like I was setting out to do this and this and I had goals and aspirations. It was, I want to survive. I want to live. I want to be on this earth and want to actually be on this earth.
Yeah, your survival turned into a business, but it was really your own survival.
Well, you know, when we get healthy is when we look just like you said, like that.
You get dangerous.
If I get one more, my freaking guys take their life, I'm going to lose it.
And that's how I feel.
And that's what happens to me. Like, I don't worry about anything about myself. I don't have problems at all.
Nope.
Because my freaking guys. And when you turn around and our teammates, and same with you, like we're connected by that uniform and all those freaking wars they stuck us in. And then when you get a crew that's had to go through that, and then we have to suffer like this, then it's like that. You know, that just made us stronger.
That's a different level. What you do when, and I don't think the government realized that, because Veterans Affairs,
they got no idea.
They fucked up. Sorry. Veterans Affairs in Canada and the United States are almost the exact same, right? We love to just neglect. In Canada, we offer medical assistance in dying instead of treatment. I mean, they've stopped now because they got caught. But my point is, what they did is they made a bunch of veterans from GWAT go, we're going to test all this stuff on you. We're going to test you in war. We're going to test you at home.
100%.
But all you did was make us incredibly dangerous, pissed off individuals.
Yeah. Dude, GWAT stands for God's Warriors of Terror. And you can't put whatever war you send your kids into is going to mold them.
Oh.
So you sent us to terror. Mm-hmm. Our enemy had no face, no uniforms, men, women, children, 20 years, two different environments, mountain and city, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. And then you just kept putting us back in there.
Uh-huh.
And then once people got out, it doesn't matter. You're not out. You're connected to your people who are still in there. So then you not only can you not do anything about it, you got to listen to it. And then all the drugs and everything else, they don't know what they created with the GWATs.
They don't. And here's the other thing too, I noticed, like for me when I was in, because I was so I ranked so low, like where I was when I got in, because I only did 4 years, right? Because they med released me. It wasn't my choice. That was my career. I wanted to be career. I was slated for another tour the following year. I was ready for this life and I was happy with this life. Mm-hmm. That's what my mission set was. But when they medically released me and did all of that, I wasn't super hyper connected, right? Because I was with a French unit, didn't speak a lot of French at the time. But dear God, I started this business and I stepped into the civilian world and I started educating civilians on what goes on in the military transition in the veteran community. And then COVID happened. And then I said, you know what? I'm tired of educating ungrateful individuals who do not give a flying fuck about what happens to us, whether we are homeless, whether we are drugged out of our mind, whether there's an alcohol situation happening, whether it's 22 or 44. Mm-hmm. Some people will care. You're right. They will. There are subset. And I love those humans because they don't know it, but they make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Some civilians that show up for others who actually express that, hey, this is a big deal. You guys should care more about this. I appreciate those. Like Neil, he's one of those guys. But once people in America and Canada started to take notice in the military world about what I was doing with my company and how loud I had been and how, or what some people like to say, you're too loud, you're too obnoxious, and you swear too much. Okay, so what's David Goggins then?
Yeah.
A male version. So that's okay. So I go out, I make all this noise, and I start screaming about people that are killing themselves at a pace that is just so beyond unacceptable. That's when people started to take notice. That's when people in the community started to reach out. And now I'm a hub, and I said this to you. I'm a hub for people because I've been screaming about suicide prevention since 2016. And I'm glad with that, but it's heavy. And I'm okay with that because I now know how to deal with the weight of it. But it shouldn't be at the pace that it is. It is not needed. It is not the answer. It's not acceptable. And the fact that everyone around us goes, you know, it's cool. Let's keep just drinking a whole bunch of alcohol and let's not address the problems and have the hard conversations with our friends because we're afraid of, you know, being embarrassed or we're afraid of admitting something's wrong. I do not agree with it. I do not accept it. It is not okay in my world. And so I call people out on it and I say, hey, that's a depressant. What are you doing? Why aren't we trying fitness? Why aren't we trying nutrition? Why aren't we trying outside and grounding and looking at religion? Because we understand, you know, organized religion, as that goes down, you're seeing a subset of people that feel lost because they're not connected to anything. So that's when I found psychedelics because I was a born Catholic. So I did, you know, I did the whole communion and baptized, but I was never connected. Because it was forced down my throat in a way. I did Catholic school and all, you know, the whole thing. So I never felt connected to anything. So I never had that greater feeling. I went, and this is because of a ranger. I know you, I'm so sorry. I had to say it.
Hey, they saved my life. I talk smack. I got a dog named Ranger.
I know you do. So I feel like on some level it's okay to say.
Yeah, no, it is. They know it. They all know
I know. So I started my podcast in 2021, in October 2021. Yeah, because no, sorry, 2020, because it'll be 3 years this year. And my husband said to me, like, you know, you should get some sponsors, right? And then he goes, what about that company we saw on Shark Tank that puts bullet casings into flip-flops? Like, why don't you reach out to them? You know, because I have the patent on jewelry for bullet casings mm-hmm. and in sunglasses, and then they've got like flip-flops. So he's like, so I reach out and Matthew Griffin hits me back immediately. He's like, yeah, we go together like peanut butter and jelly. And I was like, let's go. And then,
you know what he said?
Yeah, he did. Best email ever. I still have it.
That's pretty good.
I know. He's quick like that.
Yeah, that's good.
And so my husband goes, well, you know, if you want to actually make this show successful, you better get ballsy and start asking people to be on it. And I was like, God damn. So then I was like, you want to come on the show? And then like 20 seconds later, honest to God, I'd love to. And I was like, oh my God, because I never dealt with special operators. And I always saw those individuals as people I aspired to be like, meaning an asset, never a liability, always shows up, always makes sure people, no one's ever left behind. I value those individuals and their character mm-hmm. and their integrity. So that's who I emulate. You want to be like the best, hang out with the best kind mm-hmm. of deal, right? And so he came on the show. At the end of the show, it was a virtual one. He leaned in and he does this. If you guys know Matthew Griffin from Combat Flip Flops, he does this. He looks into your soul. So he looked into the camera and he goes, you good? And then I go, yeah, everything's great, right? He goes in again, are you good? And I would just, it's something just buckled. Mm. And we got talking. He goes, listen, there's this organization called the Heroic Hearts Project and there's a ceremony in 30 days. Mm-hmm. And I go, but I'm on an SSRI. And he goes, well, you can't be. And I went, Roger, okay. I know what needs to happen now. Called my doctor and I said, I'm getting off of this. And he goes, you've been on that for a decade? And I said, no, I'm not calling to like ask permission here. I'm getting off of this. I'm going to do this. I'm giving you a heads up. So if we call you, something goes sideways in the next 4 weeks, you know why. And he goes like, all right, cool. And so I got online with Jesse from Heroic Hearts and I went down and I did my first set of ayahuasca ceremonies. And it was the first time, and this is a big deal and I'll tell you why. When I left the Canadian Army, I was left. No one called, no one knew where I was, no one cared. Mm-hmm. And I felt that and I knew that. And when I came down to where we went, I walked into a room and there was a Blackwater guy and a SEAL and a Ranger and a Ranger and a MARSOC dude and all of these dudes. And I sat down and I didn't say a word and I was the only woman, shocker. And they all came over and hugged me. And they said, welcome in, sister. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had a community again. And that was a big deal for me. And ever since then, those are my tribe. Those are my pack. Those are my boys. They show up for me. When my husband collapsed, they showed up for me. These guys, Griff and all of these people, they show up for me. And to not only have it from such high level individuals who take character and integrity as everything. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've never been on a pharmaceutical drug. Ever since then, I've worked so deeply woven into this community with these organizations and getting everyone help. If you have access to me, I will make the call for you. And everybody knows that. I will drop what I'm doing. Half the time my husband goes, what do you do all day? You're on the phone every second of the day I see you if you're not podcasting. I said, I'm making calls because this guy needed this and this guy needed this and this guy's wife just left and this guy's wife just died and now he just died and now his kids need this. And so I will put myself last because the one thing I was taught in ayahuasca is I was given an animal, a way for me to connect to something deeper. And that animal stands for leadership. And that animal eats less. And that animal is always at the back of the pack and makes sure no one is left behind. And it's the wolf. And that is me. And that's how I feel for my community. I will fight for my community. And I was taught that you don't have to fight every battle. You don't have to bite anymore. You can just sit back because you have a tribe. You have a pack of people. You're not in this alone anymore. And so these guys I've sat with now, I sit with ayahuasca on a pretty regular basis and I use the medicine to connect and heal. And now I'm finally at a point where I feel good and I feel great. And then I did brain treatment and I'm like, I'm on some new shit. And when I say I got dangerous, it's a scary level to feel this good. Mm-hmm. It's scary. And so now I give everything I have to this community through my business, through my podcast, through my book, through anything I do, my charities I work with, I show up. I don't care what you need. You just need to ask. And that comes down to the you just need to ask for help conversation that I don't care if you're a 6'5", 300-pound bad dude. If you're struggling, you need to ask for it.
If you have stars, parallel bars, or chevron scars, I mean, we found a freaking out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we all did the decade worth of stuff. Names you can't even pronounce.
Oh, yeah.
Side effects that were...
Oh, yeah. Cool. Long term, too.
Which is awesome, right? What'd you turn me into?
Yeah.
That kind of thing?
Yeah.
But, yeah, there absolutely is a way out.
There's 100% a way out. But what was wild for me, and I don't know, maybe this is... Fuck it, I ask personal questions. How'd you feel when Afghan pullout went up?
It's like the rest of us.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? We all fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I asked
the fighters know exactly what that was.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why we don't say anything. I mean, you could feel it right now. What are you even talking about?
No, the reason I say is because I've asked a couple people and it's been an interesting response. But the reason I bring it up is because when that happened, even though I wasn't in anymore, because of the community that I just built around me, that's how I got involved in the pullout. And I got pulled back to that. But what it gave me the opportunity was Griff called again.
All of our guys went back in.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Your guys went back in and so, I couldn't go.
This is usual.
Canada blacked out on that. We didn't help any of the Canadians we left there at all. So Griff called and he said, I got a pack of nine. I got the VIP. She's the head of the women's rights for the Afghan government, and her family's on the list. There are 9-pack of Canadians. I can't get them. You're going to have to pull them. So because of the community I'd created around me and the people that we've helped, we used Instagram and Signal, and then the Americans on the ground. By the time I annoyed enough people, I got to the top with a few people, and I had a bunch of guys, a guy named Austin, who was an ex, I believe, Ranger, former Ranger, and he was doing some contracting stuff.
Yeah.
And they went and
our
did
guys
some
just
nasty.
For fun.
Yeah, they just
to do it because it needed to be done. Like all that Air America, all them TV shows that we had as kids, you know, the movies about guys sneaking in there and we're doing that.
Yeah, and it was the best feeling. And what I got from that was I got to go close a chapter. I got to go help some people and close a chapter in my life that I didn't get to close because of how I left Afghanistan. So I ended the book on that because that was it felt like a full circle healing moment for me where I did not have to regret the way I left that country. Mm-hmm. I didn't leave anybody behind.
Well, here's the deal. We're not designed like the other conventions. We're GYs. It means we go in there for a fight, like a daily, an individual, boom, 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 the big over thing. When people talk about all the equipment, guns, all the armament, everything that we left there, that upsets people. I started telling people, hey, look, we left it there, so if we need it, we don't have to fly
it
over there.
We have to steal it. It's
saving
right on
there.
Shipping. We're saving
they're
on shipping.
Keep tires are going to move the tires for us.
That's
right. Don't worry about
it. We're going to rotate it.
People underestimate what we can do.
But historically, that's what every war has done.
Yeah.
They leave it. If we were able to go back to Peleliu in World War II when they fought in the Pacific, the Battle of Peleliu, I mean, it is out in the middle of fucking nowhere. Mm-hmm. And we went out there. There are still all the tanks. Yeah. American tanks. All the anti-aircraft guns. Samurai sword
leaning against a tree, AKs.
Literally all of the weapons of war. 30-millimeter
cannons. And
that would be the jungle. Wild it's, you see. If y'all, I gotta vacation, go there.
You know, yeah, crew. Yeah. The jungle just grew over it.
Yeah. It just...
And you can just go there and see it. There's nothing protecting it. There's nobody, like, standing guard saying,
that's
don't
like the
get
World
on
War
that.
II stuff in a lot of places in France and stuff. We did, my husband and I did the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, cool.
We rode.
Hey, good for you for doing that. Yeah,
well, we flew over and did a charity event. We rode 600 kilometers on road bikes and raised money. So we landed on Juneau Beach, but we got to go see all the guns and where all the Germans were, all the Canadians were, and there's still cannons there. There's still guns there. There's still
artillery.
For people
who don't understand, we're talking about driving through America and seeing old rusty cars. And
exactly. It's
like,
wild.
But it's military hardware.
It shocks the system a bit because you go,
I mean, with the rounds. With the rounds.
It's just all rusted. And it's like the earth is just sucking it back.
But that's what America has always done is leave its equipment. Yeah. So, yes, it is very disheartening.
That's so we can make a new one.
How Afghanistan
we know why.
Yeah.
You got to have a reason, but you got to have a reason to keep the train going, keep don't
people,
we?
That's right. Keeps people jobs. Send it to make something new. Come up with new
Canada's armor, got man. No guns right now. Yeah. We have nothing. We sent it all to Ukraine. All the 777s are gone. We got nothing. So we got to make new ones. Yeah. We order them from you guys.
We're talking about that the other day. Because of the satellites, I mean, like, we have the ability to go into the room and three-dimensionally.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
So you know everyone else does.
Of course.
So any war that we're going to go down right now, they're going to know where we're at all times. It's pointless.
It doesn't have a feel to it, man.
There's no sneaking around anymore.
It's not like it was. You know what's really funny is I always thought it would be when I was like 90 years old because I never planned on writing a book. Like that wasn't like the aspirations. And I always make joke about Navy SEALs. I always say like, your book's written by buds. I'm joking. Chill out. But I always make little jokes because I comes from a place of love, but I never planned on that. And I don't think anybody really does plan on doing it. But I always pictured, because my husband jokes, he's like, you're going to be the 90-year-old in a rocking chair, sitting with a bunch of your friends. Wasn't like that in our day.
That's
he's like,
point.
But I do that now, though. Yeah. He's like, you're 33.
I got a rocking chair out there as well. That's the point.
I know. He's like, you're 33. I thought we had some decades on this before we were going to hear all this.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's been a trip, and it's been a wild, wild spot. But to be honest with you, I'm just getting my legs under me. I'm just getting my wheels started. And I'm just at a point now where I feel good enough to start taking on everything I've always wanted to take on and set those goals.
Oh, well, we say it like this. So joining the military and then going through the wars was just the initiation to get to this.
Mm-hmm.
You're not in the club yet back when you're in.
No.
In uniform. You get it when you get out.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the rite of passage.
Uh-huh.
It's just like college and university.
Right.
We had the extended tours and we were the hands-on kids and all that. That's how it worked
for
us.
The hands-on kids.
They sent us out to the field and back to Babylon.
That's right.
So now that you're out, now you graduated.
Right.
So you got to recover from it. Yeah. And then now we go.
Yeah. And you got to be like, listen, I had so many people help me. So you have to now, it's your responsibility to take the hands of at least five other people and go, this is how we do this.
Yeah.
Because no one did it for me for a decade. And I was very lucky when it happened because I don't know that I would still be here. And I can say that in all confidence and not to boast, but that's the reality. And I don't think people fully grasp that. And so when you have been given, it's your duty now to give. You just have to keep giving. And that's how things change. And you have to be loud about it. And I'm okay with being loud about it. People don't like that, especially I found in certain areas of America that is not as welcomed. You know, the loud woman conversation. I don't give a shit. I don't care if I make you uncomfortable. Good. If I made you uncomfortable, I made you uncomfortable for a reason. I made you look inward and see something you didn't like to see. Okay, well, if it's in there, then let's address it. Don't blame the voice.
Right?
Look inward. What is it that irritated you? You know what it is? My light irritates a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You want light like that? Then let's get healed. And we can do this shit together. You don't have to do it alone.
Yeah.
That's the difference. So yeah, that's where we're at now.
So how did you find the therapist that you did end up liking?
I didn't find him. I got cured. So this is that situation where you hear about the people who are like, oh, I got a good case manager, but 99% of the people got shit bags.
Yeah.
I got handed to Dr. Passy because I moved to British Columbia where my husband lived. Mm-hmm. And it was at the operational stress injury clinic. And I fell into his hand and in his care. And it's like, I don't know whether he saw like a daughter in me or he just saw that I wanted to feel better, but I just didn't know how. Mm-hmm. And once he figured out my language, meaning like, how do I teach her? Because I'm not the person where you can say like, this is, you know, tell me about how hard it was. Let's do exposure therapy. That doesn't work for me. Tell me what's going on with my neurons. Tell me why my frontal lobe isn't working. Tell me how we get it going again. Tell me the tools and I'll go do it. Mm-hmm. But you have to talk to me a certain way to educate me enough to then go, okay, that's why that feels that way. Okay, so if I do this, yeah, like that's how I work. And so once he found my language,
you can see it. It's almost as if, like some people try to have it. And
yeah.
Some of us, like just by war and by design, it's almost like every time you go out, it puts a piece of armor on you. Mm-hmm. So imagine most everybody walking around looking like a RoboCop armor. They don't mm-hmm. even know they have it on.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know you're wearing it.
Right.
Right.
That's the problem. But then there's people who had to go through the same thing. They can see it. And they're like, okay, yes. And then, but then, because you don't, if you're not knowing, you're not acting the... It crosses itself, and you can see it plain as day.
I can see
right?
it from a mile away. I can see it the way you stand. I can see it the way you move, and I can see it in your eyes.
Yeah, that'll
people,
be.
And that makes others uncomfortable because they, when they're talking to me, they realize I can see it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I've been since I've been itty bitty, mm-hmm. right? And then once I started using plant medicine, and I started really going inward, and I started doing the work, and I really started to listen and to really hear, and I was like, oh, this is about to piss some people off mm-hmm. because I don't mean to do it. But I can see it in people and I can't not address it. Like I can't, I have to.
Mm-hmm.
Because if somebody walks by and I know that they were struggling and I could see it and I'm like, oh, and they walk away, if something ever happened or they did something, I would be very disappointed in myself for not just having the balls to be like, dude, what is going on with you?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we fix this?
Right. Have you told him, do you still talk to him?
Oh yeah, like, we text. Like, I talk to him every week, so I still do treatment every week.
What is his thought on plant medicine?
So he comes from the old school world of, like, mm-hmm. where, you know, drug and rat. But he's also a very brilliant individual, and he goes, these pharmaceuticals are killing people.
Mm-hmm.
These pharmaceuticals are wreaking havoc long-term on men and women. They are causing problems. They are not fixing problems. They are numbing you. They are not healing you.
Mm-hmm.
When I was his first, besides cannabis, because he was the person to get cannabis passed for veterans to have access in Canada. So I can order cannabis on a website and it comes via FedEx and my tax dollars pay for it. And I get X amount.
Oh my gosh.
And I get X amount a month. And so that's how that works. So he knows how that works. Now, I was his first patient to bring up some psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, look, like, I don't need you to believe in it. I don't need you to do anything with it. I just need you to trust that this is where I'm at and I just need your support.
Mm-hmm.
He started crying on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I hope that you feel even 1% of the peace I feel right now with what you went through in Bosnia and Rwanda, because he was there doing the genocide as a medic.
Mm.
So I said, I want that for you so desperately, because now I see the hurt in him, but I know he's gotten to a point where he's good, but I also see the deep rooted things in him.
Yeah.
And once that happened, he started to become educated on psilocybin. He spoke on a panel, on a psilocybin panel with me, advocating for microdosing as a form of antidepressant property and macrodosing for trauma. And then once, you know, you started to see Johns Hopkins and you started to see Harvard and you started to see all these amazing studies and research, it's undeniable in terms of a healing. And then I was asked to be a patient zero for a clinical trial in Canada now for a macro dose level for psilocybin to get veterans access. So if this trial goes well with me, then all other Canadian veterans are going to have access.
That's awesome.
And to be paid for the same way to go through treatment that Heroic Hearts Projects do and that Vet Solutions does and that these other, you know, CXC and all these organizations do to get our vets help, because we know it takes from within the community to heal the community. No one else is going to do it for us.
Right.
And we've seen that.
Oh, we started.
Yeah, we're advocates, are asked because we are advocates for plant medicine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm trying to do from the inside out is going to those kind of old school therapists and the good guys. I mean, mm-hmm. not the
yeah
whatever. I mean, there's like
the open-minded individuals who just want to see people heal.
Yeah, that are really interested in end result and in just getting their take on it. That's why I asked what he thought, because that's who we have to, I think, reach first. Mm-hmm. And then on another level, we have to reach the evangelical world, because we do have this huge... it's the soundbite of psychedelic. It scares us. The word scares us.
But what happens when, look at everything else we've been fearful of and what we do when we are fearful of it instead of just trying to understand it.
Right. Well, so I'm on your side on
100%.
This. 100%. I am a very faith-based person. Mm-hmm. I am a devout Catholic, but I also believe in plant medicine, and I wholeheartedly advocate for it because I know that it's connected.
Isn't it?
It's
what God created.
It's what God, it shows us what God intended for us to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in
this. You can't
abuse it. Yeah, you can't. That's right. It's not abusable.
That's what psychedelics are great. And people don't understand that. Like that's, so I just finished.
Not that you can't. You don't want to either.
Exactly. And so I just finished my integration coaching program. So I'm going to be working with psychedelic and integration and veterans before they do programs now, which is I'm so grateful for that, because there's right ways to do this and there's wrong ways to do this.
Yes.
When the best way I've come down to explain it in one word is balance.
100%.
I have such a great time and I laugh openly. So I don't want to put anything in front of that.
Right. Right.
Like people are like, I drink or I want, I was like, man, I wouldn't ever put anything in front of how happy I'm truly happy and balanced I am.
Yes. Because there is a, are you talking about psilocybin in particular? When
all the, from
all,
up to, I had to deal with the master.
Ibogaine.
So you understand though, that a lot of these psychedelics are plant medicines. And when there's a plant medicine, there is a energy that's to it. Right. And so when you mess with this stuff is serious. This is not to be trifled with. This is not for fun, for partying. This is for work and healing. Mm-hmm. And you have to have that level of respect for the medicine.
Man, those are just,
that's just,
I agree with that's the best way we can describe it. Those are just words.
I compare it.
When you grab that, when it gets a hold of you, you don't even.
Oh, yeah, no.
I compare it to, because people, you know, should it ever be legalized as a free thing? No, it should be controlled because it is dangerous and you have to have intention going in with it.
Correct.
And it does need to be a controlled environment. And I kind of link it with, if you need to go have surgery and you need to be put under anesthesia, you're not going to go buy anesthesia off the street and do it.
No, you're not.
You're not. You're going to go into a professional.
Correct.
You're going to do it for the right reasons. You're not going to go in there drunk. You're not going to go
in
there.
You're
going to
prep before. You're going to have blood work before. Right. And you're going to do the right things before.
There's a whole protocol that goes into going under.
You get some, score it, and you go to your house. And
right. Yeah. And so it's not the same. It's not what we were taught as drugs. I would never be okay with recreational drugs. This is not a drug.
That's right.
This is actual medicine that is curing alcoholism,
drug addiction. It teaches you the difference between a medicine and a drug.
And it's healing trauma. And it's not just, yes, our veterans are our guinea pigs for this, because they always are. But it's working.
Mm-hmm.
But this can help everybody. This can help. It does help everybody. It helps.
Yeah, not it can. It
if you were raped as a child, if you
childhood trauma
were
is one of the biggest ones.
And it also, which a lot of people don't believe in this, but as a devout Catholic, I do believe in this, is generational
That's not even a Catholic thing. Generational trauma goes way back. If you look at plant medicines and you look at tribal think and you look at indigenous and you look at Native American, there is a direct, they can see, actually, oh my God, I'm so glad that you said that. I literally saw a post right before I came where it shows that mitochondria in the body can hold stressors for up to 50 generations, I believe it is. So that is generational trauma. It's real. It's trackable.
Generational trauma is a real thing. And even like they say alcoholism, like,
yes,
you have to be the one to pick it up and drink it. But if you're parents did that and grandparents did that and great-grandparents did that, you're more susceptible to doing that as a numbing effect.
Absolutely.
And this can break the chain.
And it is. And you're seeing it, especially with addiction, especially with drinking. Ibogaine is absolutely fantastic for addiction. Yeah. Ayahuasca does wonders for heart openers. Psilocybin is amazing for antidepressant properties and slapping snow down on those neurons and giving them the opportunity to create new pathways. Mm-hmm. Cannabis is fantastic for sleep. There are weight and muscle for CBD and inflammation, which is fantastic for traumatic brain injury. So the amount that you need is so minimal and it can make such a powerful effect. That's what scares the hell out of pharmaceutical companies. Oh, yeah. That's what scares the hell out of the government.
Well, that's where the rub is.
Big pharma
It's going to be the biggest
fight. It's going to be our biggest fight.
The best part about being in the military is we can sidestep that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when it comes to civilians wanting this and having to do it, mm-hmm. that's where you're going
to
see a fight.
There's going to be a big fight. That's unfortunate because this could change the trajectory of how our
generations.
World works yeah. and for generations. But it can really change. Everybody says, you know, they talk about mental health, but they don't offer solutions other than pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And
they are And I said this at a Senate subcommittee meeting like two or three weeks ago. They are an acknowledged failure mm-hmm. from Veterans Affairs. They have acknowledged it and admitted it, that CBT, talk therapy, traditional therapy in conjunction with pharmaceutical medication is an acknowledged failure. Mm-hmm. So if we know if it's a failure, why do we keep doing the same things and expecting a different result?
Right.
You have to change the record, do something different. And it's okay to not be sure mm-hmm. if it's going to go well. We'll give it a go because we're that desperate to heal. And like I said to them, stop handcuffing us because we will find somebody to undo those handcuffs and we will go do it anyway. Mm-hmm. I had to go to South America because Canada could not provide help. Mm-hmm. If you can't do it, you don't get to stop me from going and healing myself. That's just end of conversation.
Right. And what's so crazy is all of the funding so far, even with John Hopkins and Stanford and right now UT Dell Medical Center is doing all of these studies, and it's all privately funded.
Yeah.
How sad is that? All privately funded, which is insane.
I do understand that part of it, but in order for something to be publicly funded, we probably need to run it through the traps because if you just open it up like that, if it screws up, then we're all going to be like, hey,
funded.
Why didn't you take your freaking time?
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. But we're
our own worst enemies.
Why is it different than an antidepressant that's a pharmaceutical?
Because here's the
thing.
They're
publicly funded.
And they're not just publicly funded. They hide results. We know that now. They only publish stats that they want people to see. And even before the trial starts, if there's adverse reactions, they remove those people from the study.
Yeah.
So we know that it's manipulated. We understand that the data is manipulated. When you look at psychedelics, it's so blatantly obvious at such a high percentage that these are effective and long-term
effective. You're never going to see me again.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to go in and I'm going to go about my way. That's what you're trying you're trying to do with all these other stuff.
Yes, you want to see you all the time.
So you'd rather have me on 60 different types of pills, or I can just take this one and I won't ever have to come back for anything else.
You're worth so much money. People are worth so much money and they don't see that.
I don't get that.
Yeah.
Well, that's just cruelty. That's just evil.
I feel like you're picking on me. You know that kind of thing?
Yeah. 100%. But you should be able to heal and you should be able to have access. And if that means we don't have to legalize it recreationally, but we need to look at getting access.
And it shouldn't be legalized recreationally.
No, because
that is actually, that's our danger zone.
Of course it is.
So there does need, and that's a big thing because we were just in Washington, D.C. talking about this. And there right now, there's a huge group of people that are trying to legalize it
recreationally.
Legalize recreationally. Mm. And they are hopping on this bandwagon of veterans using it for help, where that's get off our back.
What?
We're not trying to legalize. We're trying to decriminalize in order for us to have these legit studies done, mm-hmm. be able to provide research to show the evidence of the healing. But a lot of research is being halted right now because it's a Schedule I.
Right.
So we need that rescheduled mm-hmm. in order to be able to have legitimate research done to be able to show, okay, this does need to be offered in
a controlled, safe setting.
And with that, you can heal people.
Exactly. But you're talking about a conversation, right, where, I mean, if you want to look at what legalized – like a decriminalization of Schedule 1 can do, you know what they're going to point to? Go look at the east side of Vancouver. Yeah. We have the highest overdose rate in the world.
Yeah.
And you know why, though? Because they let everybody out of all the psych wards and they dumped everybody onto the streets. Mm-hmm. So they're using these opportunities to say that this is going to be like that. Mm-hmm. But it is not.
I mean, why? So they kill themselves?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're
eventually
no.
You die off,
no,
because right?
What happens now is they allow, so we have safe injection sites, so it's open air drug consumption.
Yeah,
and
but
you don't
still,
get,
the chances of you killing yourself doing that are pretty high, right?
Pretty damn high. So and, that, but the overdose rate
the whole
is
concept,
like,
is just yeah, put them out there, give them
I
all
mean,
the drugs.
I mean, think about it, they're
you.
Less for the government to worry about.
Yeah.
They're people with mental health, but then you know what you're starting to get? You're starting to get stabbings left, right, and center because they're bleeding into the rest of Vancouver. A father was at a Starbucks with his wife and young daughter, and a guy was vaping at his kid. He asked him to stop. Did the first mistake. He turned around and took him out of his eyesight. Guy came up, took a knife, and shoved it into his jugular. And everyone in Vancouver watched it happen with their phones, and no one tried to stop the bleeding. And the guy sat down and waited for the cops and kept vaping in front of the mother and child while her husband bled out. Because we don't care about the mental health epidemic. We don't care what happens to people. If it's out of sight and out of mind, it's not our problem. Mm-hmm. But when you try to heal others and you put it in their eye, they're struggling so hard with psychedelics because we've brainwashed a population since the Nixon era to go, these things are going to make you crazy. These things are going to break your brain. Well, I'm sorry. I know a ton of people, some of the smartest people in the world who use psychedelics on a fairly frequent basis. And they are the most grounded, level-headed, well-perceived individuals, hardworking, society-contributing human beings. Mm-hmm. And they're healed. And they're not bleeding all over everyone else yeah. because they've actually healed themselves.
Right.
Yeah, out in the streets, pumping up and all that stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're not doing that.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
So when you let humans take control of it, you know, it's not that they're going to abuse it, but they'll definitely try and have a good time
with it. They're gonna push the line.
Yeah, they're gonna try and have a good time with it.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, and say it either way you want, but that's what happens.
Then you give it to veterans and they're like, how much are you sitting with this time? And then the guy beside him goes, I'm doing a little more. And he goes, fuck it, I'm doing a little more. And you're like, oh, here we go.
Don't be alone.
They're going to go, we got to find those guardrails.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing your story today.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me.
And how can people follow you, get your podcast, all of that? Can you?
Yeah, so everything is, as you can see, is co-branded under Brass and Unity. The book you guys can buy, it's through Post Hill under Simon & Schuster. So you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it anywhere. You can buy books. It's on pre-sale right now. So it's on pre-sale until the date of release, which is July 11th. So I've got between now and July 18th to sell 6,000 books to be the first female GWAT on the New York Times bestseller list. And
Is that what we need to do?
Yeah, because Jessica Lynch got a national bestseller. We haven't seen one that's a New York Times. I'm gonna try to crack some shit and break some shit.
See if we can get it done then.
That's my goal. And so I've been making that known, and because I made the mistake of saying it out loud, and then I heard that voice in me, that imposter syndrome voice that said, why did you say that? You're never gonna do that. And I went, watch me, bitch.
Yeah.
So everything is Brass and Unity. The website's brassandunity.com. We ship everywhere in the world. If Americans purchase product from Canada, from us, because I'm Canadian. If it comes from America, the donate.
Some of us are big fans of Canadians. I happen to be.
I know, but some aren't because of our current climate. And so if you buy from America, the donation stays in America. If you buy from Canada, the donation stays in Canada. Same with Europe and Australia. So we keep it fair for the veteran population. And then all of our products.
Oh, so it's competition.
No, it's not a comp. Well, I'd like to see.
We should make it a competition. Okay. That way we can sell more books.
You know what? It's a competition. I'll tell you what. If my book, all the sales come from America, I will write a bigger check to the American organizations from that. Because we're writing from the book. We're donating from the book.
Hey, that's now, great, but it's all about bragging rights.
Marcus,
who supports you the
competition.
Most?
Okay.
America or Canadians?
To be honest?
Well, no, we're about to find out.
Okay. I know who does jewelry-wise.
We're about to find out. That's what this
Who
is.
Who does jewelry-wise?
Through Simon & Schuster House?
It's Post Hill and it's distributing through Simon & Schuster, yeah. I'm not big enough to hit the real Simon & Schuster yet, so that's the next book
on. How you grow. That was probably one of the most exciting times of my life is when I got to do that. Yeah. I got to dress up in uniform, go into New York to all the publishing houses. You know, it smells like a library when you walk in there.
Yeah. I was not welcomed that way. Mine was shopped by my literary agent at Inkwell, and they shopped it, and two people looked at it, and the one had already done some war books and the other hadn't. And there aren't a lot of female stories out there. And I really wanted somebody that was going to say, hey, like, we believe in what this is and what you're trying to achieve with this, because we don't see the mother side, the female side, the stuff that happens after. I'm not saying like, I'm not pulling the women empowerment card, but I'm just saying I just happen to be a woman and this just happens to be my story. And we all have stories. And I think every veteran should get the opportunity to tell their story, but these people believed in it and took it. And so I'm happy with it now. And I'm working on a second book. It's on something completely different, but you know, this has cracked open a journey for me. So my goal is I want that list. I think I deserve it. I think the book's good enough. I think it's got good enough stories and enough people have come to support me with this book. So now it's about, let's see what the veteran community will do, because I do traditional TV, right? And they buy it because they're like, oh my God, it's a woman empowerment. And then you've got the veterans who are like, I don't know. Was it any good? You think she did anything good? Do you think it's good? And they listen to other veterans. So I'm curious. Like,
what'd she say about me?
Exactly. Talking
that's
shit.
What it is.
Oh, you know
talking
what?
Talking shit? I bet they're talking. Oh, that's exactly what that is.
I talk some shit. I changed the names.
That's the best part about having your military backing you up. I was like, she talked some shit? She did. I read it.
That's so funny.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's everything's there, but that's the goals and everything's Brass and Unity. And we have our show on all platforms and Patreon. We started now. It's the Brass and Unity podcast. And we talk to people like Travis Pastrana. We talk to Navy SEALs. You haven't been on yet. I'd love to have you on. We talked to a lot of doctors, TBI stuff. I want people to, well, and they do. I somehow am able to get them to tell stories that they haven't told anywhere else because I make them feel, I make that little thing in them crack and then it just comes out. So I'm honored to get to hear those stories and share those stories. And the goal is to do that full time where that can just be my career. And I love it. I love every minute of it.
Awesome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for what you do. Thanks for your service.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Kelsey, for coming down. And if you enjoyed this show, please give it a thumbs up wherever you get your podcasts. I promise you'll want to keep up with everything she's got going on. She's very inspiring, and you'll love her book. Thank you guys for listening in, and we'll see you next week.